Hi and hello and welcome to the RBR.music podcast. My name is Steve Curley and as always I'm joined by the creator of the RBR.music Instagram page, Jordan Murray. Hello.
Hello.
Where each episode in true RBR fashion will be bringing you classic and new album reviews. It's our mission to cut through the noise to discuss the sound. Firstly, before we get started this episode, a big thank you to everyone who took part in our recent Instagram poll. We put two classic albums up against each other, The Who, Who's Next, and Fleetwood Mac's Rumours, and a battle of the kings and queens, with Fleetwood Mac winning with 62% versus 38%. So, on the RBR radar this episode, Rumours by Fleetwood Mac. Over to you, Jordan Murray.
Okay, Rumours. Certainly like us to work for our money on this podcast with Rumours. Okay, Rumours is the kind of album that transcends its origins and reputation, entering the realm of legend. It's an album that simply exists outside of criticism. So that's the end of the podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, guys, for listening. Bye.
It's lovely. But here we are attempting to critique it. Even though it's thoroughly, how do you say that word, Steve?
Thoroughly.
Yep, that's the one. Captures its era. So Fleetwood Mac, Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, obviously cool, bluesy, amazing, brilliant, yet moderately successful. But here they turned into full-fledged phenomenon with Rumours, becoming the biggest-selling pop rock album to date. While its chart success was historic, much of the legend surrounding the record is born from the group's internal turmoil. Unlike most bands, Fleetwood Mac in the mid-70s were professionally and romantically involved, with no less than two couples in the band, but as the professional career took off, the personal side unravelled. So let me give you a bit of history with the personal side of things. Bassist John McVie and his keyboardist singer wife Christine McVie filed for divorce as guitarist, vocalist Lindsay Buckingham and vocalist Stevie Nicks split, with Stevie running into the arms of Mick Fleetwood, the drummer, unbeknown to the rest of the band. Ooh, it's very much like a soap opera. It is, isn't it?
Tell me more.
So these personal tensions fueled nearly every song on Rumours, which makes listening to the album a nearly voyeuristic experience. You're eavesdropping on the bandmates singing painful truths about each other, spreading nasty lies and rumours. Wallowing in their grief. All in the presence of the person who caused the heartache, which I just think is incredible. So it would appear that everybody loves to gawk at a good public breakup. As in, because this was such a highly well-selling album. I'm under the impression that fans knew about the breakup when this was happening. Because it wouldn't have been, there'd be no internet. I'm guessing there would have been music magazines or newspapers and stuff. What I believe made Rumours an unparalleled blockbuster is the quality of the music. Once again, masterminded by producer, songwriter, guitarist Buckingham, Rumours is an exceptionally musical piece of work. He toughens Christine McVie and softens Nicks, adding weird turns to accessible melodic works, which gives the universal themes of the song haunting resonance. It also cloaks the raw emotion of the lyrics in deceptively palatable arrangements that made a tune as wrecked and tortured as Go Your Own Way an anthem of a hit. But that's what makes Rumours such an enduring achievement. It turns private pain into something universal. Some of these songs may be too familiar, whether through their repeated exposure on radio or commercials, or they've even been played for presidential campaigns. But in the context of the album, each tune, each phrase regains its raw, immediate emotional power, which is why Rumours touched a nerve upon its 1977 release and has since transcended its era to be one of the greatest, most compelling pop albums of all time. Yes, I like the album.
You certainly do.
But, yeah, so also let me just touch on the album's influence. Though it was seen as sort of, bear with me with this, punk's beginning, because it was obviously punk kicks back against the likes of Rumours and Led Zeppelin with their huge stadium acts and stuff. Rumours has enjoyed a long trickle down of influence, starting from, I'd say, the alt-rock era Embrace. Smashing Pumpkins, Billy Corgan, and Courtney Love, the way they harmonise. And also there's a great guy called Bonnie Prince Billy, and the earthier end of Beach House, I think, they sound like Rumours. So obviously I've touched on 90s stuff there, and a bit of present day bands, but this was made in 77, so it's constantly with us, this album. Resonates in new bands coming to the forefront. Rumours set a template for pop with a gleaming surface that is something complicated, desperate and dark resonating underneath. Like I've said, I've probably said this a few times in these episodes, but I just love the quote, is where Tom Waits says, "I love beautiful melodies telling me awful things." And this, again, Rumours, is exactly that. Setting aside the weights of history, listening to Rumours is an easy pleasure. Records with singles that never go away tend to evoke nostalgia for the time when the music soundtracked your life. You may have never owned a copy of it, yet still know almost every song. For me, the first time I heard this was on a cassette, an unmarked cassette. My dad probably recorded it off his friend's vinyl or off his own vinyl, I don't know. But we used to listen to it in the car. And for years, I thought this was Fleetwood Mac's best of, because I wasn't aware of Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac. I was just aware. I was like, every single song is just an outright banger. This is just phenomenal. So I just thought it was a best of until I educated myself, of course.
Like a good gateway drug, yeah.
Yes, that's one way to put it. And
the reason I say that is it's a massive gateway. You can start with Rumours, like you did at a young age, or anyone could at an old age, and it just opens every door back to.
Yeah, that's why. That's why I genuinely thought it was a best of, because I was like, this is just picking, but it works so well as an album. Because there's so much heartache in it, and longing and loss. So when you actually break down the lyrics and stuff, you realise that, it's obviously not a best of. But I think what is striking about this album is its accessibility. This isn't generic pulp when I say everyone seems to be able to access this album and enjoy it. It was personal. Anyone could find a piece of themselves within these songs of love and loss.
You've started with the highest of sort of accolades and views from it, and you've tipped into sort of the well, the eventual influences and where it sort of, you know, pointed them and other artists. I mean, I believe Mick Fleetwood was quoted saying it was the most important album ever made because it allowed them to continue the success and make music for years to come. It sort of, I suppose it shelved them, didn't it, as a...
Yeah, as much as I absolutely adore blues and all genres within the blues sort of umbrella, you can't, if you want to be successful, well, how do you say you're successful? As Bob Dylan said, if you go to bed and wake up and do what you want to do, that's being successful. I may have not said that quote exactly, but you get my drift. But yeah, you can't be stagnant. I think you've always got to be moving forward. And I think it did shock and upset the hardcore blues fanatics. But it opened the gates, and it opened me up to their back catalogue. Hearing it
that's what I mean. If I'd been, you know, a teenager or, you know, a 20-something at the time, I think you can see where Fleetwood Mac was starting to go with Fleetwood Mac, the 1975 album, because, like, you can hear shoots of Rumours in there. I mean, I think it's a great album.
That's
that one
the
too.
That's Rihanna in that.
Rihanna, Over My Head, another good one. But I think my point was going to be that was their 10th album, Rumours the 11th album. They still went on to produce, I don't know, 7-8 more albums, like studio albums. I know they've done a hell of a lot of live stuff as well, but like, it's funny that a band that appeared in the late 60s, we're talking mid to late 70s now, and they've gone through such an amalgamation of sound, as everyone famously knows, and you'll always get that conversation of, I think your term was the Peter Green Fleetwood Mac and Fleetwood Mac. And you'll always get your people like my dad, who turned off after Peter Green stepped away. It wasn't for him. He's like Jordan referred to himself, very much a blues man. So it wasn't for him, you know, he was an Albatross fan over sort of anything that Rumours, that he respects the album. He's got a lot of love for it, but fundamentally, yeah, you'll create that divide. But I think what we were alluding to from just skimming the top of this, it's such a well embedded album. And what we are now, is it 48 years later? Have I done my maths right there? 40.
I'm not very good at maths, so I'll just agree with you.
48 years later. Let's face it.
Carry the two. Yeah, 48 years. Yeah. Just have to work that on.
It must be an album that is in a lot of households, UK, US, around the world. I mean, my girlfriend Sophie, it's one of her top five albums of all time. She has five records, vinyls, and this is one of them. And it's like
the other one is Fleetwood Mac. Fleetwood Mac Live, 1977.
But no, it's true. I mean, obviously, I won't bore you with her five, but it's an eclectic five, and this is in there, and it's very much one of her favourites. And I know her mum would have played it while they were growing up, like my mum did, like your dad did, you know. It is very...
I'm my mum, yeah.
Very easy. It's a very easy album on the ears, and we'll come back to it later. It's also, I think, the influence of you nodding to bands taking it on and sort of, you know, it inspiring them or them doing bits with it. I think there was, in the late 90s, a bit of a tribute. I think it was either an album or a performance where... I think quite a few people stepped up and did covers. I think, you know, like Matchbox 20 and the Goo Goo Dolls, the Cranberries, the Coors. Like, so that's 30 years on at that point. So, or 20, 25 years on that point. So it's quite timeless. I think that's what we're definitely sort of alluding to, and Timeless on mass ears, right?
I think absolutely correct. Though Fleetwood Mac was always a sum of its parts. The old, even when Peter Green was around, I think they needed one another. So they are a band. It's not just like you don't know the band and you, it's just the front man. And it's like, well, if that makes sense. It was, the band's is, like I said, the sum of its parts. So, but Nicks, when they enlisted Nicks, Stevie Nicks, Nicks was something special, both in terms of the band and in rock history. She helped establish a feminine vernacular that was still in league with the cock rock of the 70s, but didn't present as a vulnerability. It was not innocent. Look, let me put this a bit simpler. So
Janis Joplin
and Grace Slick had been rock's most iconic women at the tail end of the 60s. They were very much trying to keep up with the boys in the rock world. I mean, granted, they gave as good as they got, but it was still very, them being like lads, ladettes, if you want to take a phrase from the 90s. But Nicks was creating a new space, and Fleetwood Mac was still very much an anomaly, unique in being a rock band fronted by two women who were writing their own material, with Nicks presenting as the girliest bad girl rock and roll had seen since Ronnie Spector. She took to the stage, bearing a tambourine. She had lengths of lavender ribbon. I mean, with all this mythos, like the Led Zeppelin mythos and stuff, people actually thought she was a witch.
Right.
Like her male rock and roll peers, Nicks sang songs about the intraceable power of a woman and used women as a metaphor, as in one of the songs on this album, Gold Dust Woman. But her approach was different. At the time of Rumour's release, she maintains that the latter song was about groupies who would scowl at her and Christine but light up when the guys appeared. She later confessed that it was about cocaine getting the best of her.
Newsly, the all-in-one super app for iOS and Android. How does Newsly work, I hear you ask? Well, it picks up the most trending articles on the web on topics that you choose, and at any given moment, reads them out in a natural human voice. For the first time ever, the entire web becomes listenable and all in one place. Browse articles from topics that you choose and start playing. Stop scrolling and start listening. You can follow topics such as sport, tech, business, science, or even music. They have a podcast as well. Explore trending podcasts from over 80 countries. Our podcast, the RBR.music podcast, is there too. I've started using it as my default podcast app, and they even have digital radio. So download and start using Newsly for free from www.newsly.me in the description. And if you use the promo code, that's RBRMUS, you'll receive 1 month free premium subscription. Go and give it a go.
Nick's husky voice made it sound like she'd lived her lyrics. The independence and getting played certainly backed it up. She seemed like a real woman, easy to identify with, but with mystery and natural glamour worth aspiring to. So she paved the way, I believe, as well as Janis Joplin and stuff, for rock front women. Or even, dare I say, like pop acts now, like Pink or Rihanna and people like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got a very solid point with that, because I think sort of that mid-70s era was a real kind of turning point for female, either, you know, lead or solo singers sort of stepping out of the shadows of kind of a male-dominated world. Obviously, not fully, because, you know, it takes... a continual movement. But yeah, you had like, you know, you mentioned Grace Lick, and then you've got Patti Smith and Carly Simon at the time, you know, Joni Mitchell. Like, there's a real positive movement towards a different looking front person, and I think these two definitely sort of forged that, like you said. And I think what's actually really quite interesting is, considering this band comes from the bedrock of quite a masculine, bluesy, sort of, you know, late 60s kind of heritage, I think 7 of the 11 tracks are written singly by Stevie Nicks or McVie. And actually, I think they co-wrote one or two of the others anyway. So it's a very female, headstrong, driven album, isn't it? That's how I hear it anyway, and all for the goodness that is.
Although you hinted at Christine McVie, it's almost too easy to miss McVie for all of Nick's mystique. McVie had been in the band for years, but never at the helm. So her songs, You Make Loving Fun and Don't Stop, yeah, and Songbird, all powerful songs. They're heart-wrenching. It came to light that McVie's not quite ex-husband was dragging around some rebound model girlfriend to the sessions, and Christine was sneaking around with a member of the crew. So this album is just, imagine if the album became so popular. I wonder if they thought it would become so popular, because they have to sing these songs with each other on stage about how much they dislike each other or how much they're hurting. It's just crazy. And I also think, as we're still on this topic, I mean, to say this in this day and age sounds a bit odd, but in 77, I think it was a bold move to put two lead front women on stage, and brilliantly it worked.
No, absolutely.
And we're better for it.
Absolutely. And just a little side random note here, Christine McVie was... she was a Lancashire girl. I think she was from Cumbria way.
And that's where we're from, ladies and gentlemen, if you were interested in that. There you go.
From little old Lancashire. I know this album carries so much more than just being a top-rate, long-lasting album. It's got so much... so many iconic... versions of itself, if that makes sense. It's not just the music. It is about the lead individuals, the history to this album, what led it to
but it is
to be
like
formed.
It is like this band's bear with me, is everyone is needed, like in The Who. Everyone is needed in The Who. Where you know all the band's personalities. It's like, you know, all of Fleetwood Mac's personalities. And that's why I put them together in the poll. That was my way of thinking of that. They are fairly two different bands, I'm aware of that. But in the same sort of time. Go on.
When we try and pitch them on the polls, and we'll do more of it. We don't try and pitch, you know, a little fish with a big fish. We generally want to hear, you know, a kind of a good battle, and then we can discuss.
We want to make it difficult for the followers on the Instagram account. To get everyone thinking and discussing, it's all good. I'd like to add about this album, in fact, that as much feminine energy as Rumours has, the album's magic, I believe, is in its balance of male and female. I said this when we were just chatting before we went live. It has the American-British blues sort of scenes merging. It has the British-American rock and roll. It has lightness and dark, love and disgust, sorrow and elation, ballads and anthems. It's just so well thought through. It's amazing that they were going through all this turmoil to get how good, like McVie's sweetness against Nick's grit. The band were democratic, but each player raised the stakes of the whole. The addition of Buckingham and Nick's and McVie's new prominence kicked John McVie's bass playing loose from its blues mooring and forced him towards simpler, more buoyant pop. So he's happy to play new stuff. It's not that he was like ordered to change his blues style. John McVie got Buckingham and Nick's in, so he was ready to like progress his musical style. Fleetwood's drumming is near godlike, with effortless little fills, light but thunderous, and his placement impeccable throughout. You just need to listen to The Chain for the example of how good they are as a band. I think after this album was a live album came out, and that's worth a listen just to see how good they are live. When they're at the top of the powers. I say at the top of the powers, as a band, they're falling apart behind the scenes and they're all like hooked on cocaine by the sounds of it, but you know, making good music.
Well, for anyone who doesn't know, who's interested, they did release 9 live albums, 18 studio, 9 live albums. I mean, that is pretty epic. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the album is immaculate.
Yeah, it is, and you're not alone in that. You know, we often talk about, you know, little things that might not mean much to bands, but it's good to know that we sit in good company. For anyone who doesn't know, Q magazine is a very popular British magazine founded in the mid 80s, and Q in 1998, Rumours was listed and voted third of all time, only behind The Clash's London Calling and Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, which I think, as you started with the album, at the start of the podcast, Jordan, there's a nod to the punk movement in the future, and also, I suppose, that Pink Floyd movement sort of in and around and what came off the back of it. I mean, it's pretty good company to keep with, and Q were clearly no short cover, but pretty impressive stuff. And the accolades, you can keep reading and picking up different communications on who says what about how good this album is. We don't need to keep reading that, of course. But no, I think the thing to address, Jordan, is clearly analytically and socially and professionally enjoyed every inch of this album. It is one of those albums that spoiler alert, I don't think there's a bad track. I think we discussed that previously. Every track feels iconic, right? Every minute of every song just feels like you've listened to it 100 times and you could listen to it 100 times again. There's no boring of this album.
I think it's embedded in pop culture. It's flawless. And it's pulled from the wreckage of real lives. So I don't really like this phrase, but I don't know how else to say it. It is one of classic rock's foundational albums. As you've just pointed out with Pink Floyd and things like that, it is up there with clearly the best classic rock albums you can choose.
Particularly of the mid 70s, where there was so much good kind of pop rock, wasn't there? I mean, it's like it's probably the best time ever for that Americana stadium rock, pop. Yeah, like it's just, it's off the back of kind of, I suppose, more indie hipster 60s, early 70s. It's just so, everything that sort of came out around this time is just brilliant. And I think we agreed this tops the pile easily, really.
Yeah. I believe it's called, the genre is AOR, Arena Orientated Rock.
Right, okay, AOR.
AOR.
Another genre for me, Jordan. I'm sick.
Another
of these
genre.
New genres.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, well, I don't think it's a new genre, but yeah, it's
new to me.
Yeah, it's new to you, and that's all that matters. Yeah, I'm just happy that I'm educating you.
Thank you.
Well, so actually, when I said classic rock, it's actually AOR.
Well, it's funny. In preparation to the pod, me and Jordan were talking just before we started recording, and I had tried my best to understand Fleetwood Mac's history. And we won't go into it, but I read and read, and I just could not get my head around it. Jordan has been a bit more in depth over the years and was able to kind of surmise it. But if you want to understand the quirkiness of Fleetwood Mac and the kind of roots and branches that would have been left through the history of band members leaving and arriving, you know, just have a read upon them, because it put a lot of context for me into...
Interesting reading.
Yeah, yeah, just where we
are. I could sum up this little bit of Rumours... periods of what was going on, if you like.
Go on.
It's a nice little link in there. So 2 years prior to recording Rumours, Fleetwood Mac was approximately nowhere. In order to re-establish the group's flagging stateside reputation, in early 1974, Fleetwood Mac's drummer, Mick Fleetwood, keyboardist, singer Christine McVie and her husband, bassist John McVie, moved from England to Los Angeles. The quartet was then helmed by the fifth and least, in my opinion, and least dazzling guitarist, the American Bob Welch. Not long after the band's British faction had relocated, Welch quit the band. Around the same time, Mick Fleetwood was introduced to the work of local duo Buckingham and Nicks, who'd just been dropped by Polydor. The drummer was amazed by Lindsay Buckingham's guitar work and Nicks' complete package. And when Bob Welch quit, he offered them a spot in the band outright. And when they accepted, the group, essentially a new band under an old name, quickly cut 1975's self-titled Fleetwood Mac. So, yeah, I think they had to move quick, because I think it's strange they kept the same name, but, you know, there was no one was trying to sue each other, so, yeah, why not, I suppose.
I think it was a lot more common those days as well. I think bands, well, I suppose, yeah, in and around that, bands probably did change. It was a bit of an era of the super band as well. You know, you'd have guitarists, like massive guitarists, coming out of bands left, right, and centre. Right, that was quite the done
like
thing.
Like, who did you
know,
say before?
Well, didn't John Peter?
Yep, go on.
Yeah, there wasn't Peter Green replaced Eric Clapton, didn't he? And I completely forgot the band name.
John Mayall and the Blues
Brothers. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, just yeah.
So a lot of guitarists walks through that band.
Yeah, true.
And other bands, yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, they just hopped around and they just wanted to make music. But yeah, and why not?
Well, they're adding to the rich tapestry of kind of music history and folklore, and, you know, I think it's probably something that, you know, probably goes under the radar these days with the volume of music that's put out. It doesn't really matter who, where. I think character was a lot, you know, depth of character within a band was a little bit more important maybe back then. I don't know, maybe that's a bit unfair to today's bands, but...
I think, yeah. Like, you could... The bands back in the day, you could act a bit stupid, but there wasn't cameras everywhere. There wasn't like surveillance everywhere.
Yeah.
So we still hold these gap bands like Fleetwood Mac in like sort of a mystique sort of interesting. We don't know that much. Well, we know a lot about the personal lives, but we still think the sort of, I don't know, like the mythology of it all is really interesting to us, because they weren't constantly on a website or on your phone or, you know, in a music magazine. Granted, there was music newspapers, but they were talking about the music specifically, not about what they were wearing.
Which is hugely ironic, really, when we're talking about the Rumours album, because I think the Rumours album would actually fit very well with its sort of mixed
history. It almost invented pop rock, didn't it? So, there you go.
Ignore
what I just said. Yeah.
Well, I think we can both agree this is an album that we thoroughly enjoy, have enjoyed, and will continue to enjoy. We're certainly not alone in that. I challenge anyone really to swim against the current on this one. Please do touch base if you do think that is the case. But we love it. We thoroughly enjoy it. So, of course, it's at this point of the pod that we go to our star rating. And I'll pass this one to Jord, because he's lushed and loved every minute of talking about this album. What are the hard facts on the star rating, pal?
So the hard facts are, I used to be a music snob and would really have arguments with people about certain genres of music. But if you like it, you like it, and what does it matter? This is pop rock. I don't listen to a lot of pop rock because a lot of it is bloody awful. But this is an absolute marvel. I'd give this 5 out of 5.
Which, interestingly, Jord, I think we can't say for a fact, we talked about this before, but we think from a podcast point of view, this is only the second time we've had 5 out of 5 on the podcast.
Yeah, I don't give many 5 out of 5s on the Instagram either, but I don't want to do a spoiler, although we're nearly there, but there isn't really a bad track on the album. It's just, I was trying to force myself into disliking certain songs.
Well, that's a brilliant link to take us to our pod feature, The Good, The Bad and The Rad. And as I always say, it is a good track, a bad track and a particularly rad track. I think we're going to mix things up today and start with the bad track, Jordan. What did we agree on?
That there wasn't one.
Yeah. We do often say there isn't a particularly bad track on an album that we've kind of learned or loved or, you know, sort of, you know,
It's not bad, it's just the weakest track on there. But I can't even find a weak track on there.
There isn't. It is 11 tracks of just brilliance, and we just cannot deliver a bad track. So we are sitting very much in the good and rad camp today. So, good track, Jord.
Did we agree on The Chain? The Chain.
We did, yeah. I mean, it's a very iconic song, isn't it? I think it was, what did you say, Jord? Was it used in the British Formula One racing?
For the TV, the TV show, for the opening of the Formula One, when the program's about to start, they use some of the guitar fills in that song on the program. So even before I heard the cassette of my dad's, I really used to like the build up to the Formula One, that music and stuff. And then I was amazed there was lyrics to it when I actually heard the full song. That was like, blew my mind. So this is an actual song? Wow.
And I think this one could sit in the rad track. It's a bit of a, you know, foot sort of stamper, it's a great track to throw on at a party late night when you've had a fair few whiskies and wines. But Yeah, good track. Yeah, we can't deny The Chain. Absolutely brilliant. And definitely worth listening to the remastered version as well in, I think, 2004 remastered version. So the Rad track, this was fairly easy for us both as well.
Would you like to go with it? I've just done two.
Well, we decided on Go Your Own Way, didn't we? And again, iconic to the album. Both these tracks have very singular kind of opening sort of riffs and intros. You know them straight away. This is actually my girlfriend's favourite track from the album as well, so it gets played a lot in our house. It's just brilliant, and it is such a... It doesn't build in the same way The Chain is. The Chain builds quite... it's quite an aggressive build, isn't it? It's really sort of, you know, dum dum dum. Where this has got a much smoother, but when it gets there, it's just a brilliant track, isn't it? Again, another party track. Hence why it's our rad track, wouldn't you agree, Jord?
Yeah, it is fantastic. And to be fair, if you threw a dart against the track listing, they're all up there. They're all close to rad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's some tracks as well, and we don't normally do this on the Good, the Bad, and the Rad, but there's some lovely little bits. I'm a big fan of Never Going Back Again. It's a lovely little kind of... It's got some little interludes that are just like... It's really twinkly. It's just cool, really, really cool, and it's very different. And the album isn't kind of... No songs homage each other. There's not really kind of a... There's no pattern to the album, I don't believe. It's not like... We've discussed albums recently where the first six tracks, you can pretty much go from one to six and you don't feel like you've gone from track to track. This album, yeah, definitely, yeah. You know when a song finishes and the next one kicks in and you're almost looking forward to it. I don't know about you, but I really like listening to albums in order because I get excited for track three and track five and track seven. Playlists are different, but like when I'm listening to an album, I like to listen to it how you would on a... like a vinyl, not, you know, because obviously we all listen to stuff on streaming now. I quite like a structure of how an album's built and written. Mm-hmm. And this is just, yeah, it just has all of that. And it's, yeah, really fun, really enjoyable. And, challenge us. If you think we're wrong,
but
tell us.
Because
absolutely.
We've really enjoyed talking about this, can I really upset you now, Steve?
Yeah, of course you can.
Thank you very much. It's less than 40 minutes long.
Well, so I didn't mention it because I didn't want to trip up on my own kind of my own stupidness, because I am critical of shorter albums, and I always have a theory that older albums have a bit more length within them and a few more tracks. However, as we said, this album can do absolutely no wrong, so it can be less than 40 minutes and
we'll
be 11 tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
It does not matter to me. And actually, yeah, do you know what, in a weird way, that is almost kind of a great way to sum this album up, that it's so good. It can whatever little rules you have in your music world, it can break them because it's that good. And that's how I see it. Simpler analytics for me there than yours, Jord.
Excellent. Yes. Happy days.
So, happy days indeed. Well, nice one, everyone, for listening, as always. Once again, thanks a lot for entertaining us with your votes. We love doing the polls. Jordan works very hard on the Instagram page all the time, and it's great to get so much interaction. I've mentioned it a few times over the past few pods, the recent comments, communications, likes, and various shares have been great fun. Please do keep doing so. Like, subscribe, and tell your friends about us, and invite them to have a little listen. You can leave comments and obviously any review requests at the rbr.music Instagram page or on any of the pod platforms you listen to us on. Cheers, guys.
Stevie Nicks. Everyone thought she was a witch.